We were in the Sunday school class, and Stephen and Rebecca, Jennifer's sister and brother-in-law, were in there. And we started talking, and the subject came up about just what we would be like after the resurrection and after we're changed. I thought, boy, that's a pretty good topic for a sermon there. It's a two-parter now, and it may turn into a three-parter. Because when I really started getting into it, there's a lot of things for us to learn from it. But you know, when we talk about the return of Christ, boy, there's a lot to that, isn't there? There's a lot to that. You know, we talk about the establishment of the kingdom, how the world's governments are going to completely be changed. Many, many different things. All the systems that we know of today, the judicial systems, everything, that's all going to change. But you know, there's probably no change that's more dramatic or greater than the change that we ourselves will see when Christ returns. Well, this morning, I'd like to share a story with you. And it's very relative to what we're going to be speaking about the next few weeks. It's a story of a man from Boston, Massachusetts. His name was Dr. Samuel Howe. Has anyone ever heard of Dr. Howe? No one? Very famous man in his time. Well, when I looked at the story of his life, and it really, really struck me. Really struck me in light of the return of Christ, the story of his life. He was born on November the 10th. 1801, he was born in Boston. He attended a private Latin school there in Boston. Later on, he went to Brown University. And at that time, Brown University was a very, very religious school. Nothing like we see today. It was, at that time, very religious school. And many people that went to Brown University at that time went into one of two professions. They either went into the ministry or they went into the medical field. Well, Dr. Howe went into the medical field, studied pre-med. From there, he went to Harvard University, where he graduated and earned his Doctor of Medicine in 1824. And I believe that as we go through his life a little bit quickly here this morning, that you're going to see that I really believe that that really religious Brown University at that time had a pretty substantial effect on his life. He set up his practice in Boston originally. And it was through talking to one of his patients that he became really interested in the Greek plight. If you remember back at that time, in the early 1800s, the Greeks were battling for their independence from the Ottoman Empire. I think most of us will remember that from our history lessons. And he became very interested in this. Even to the point where he went over to see what he could do. And he found out, as he went over there, there was a great need for medical attention. And he started the first ambulance corps in Europe. The very first one that there ever was. Well, he was there for about 3.5 years before he returned back to Boston. But you see, he still had this longing in his heart to help people any way he possibly could. And then from there, he began his practice once again. And he talked to a lot of his doctor friends. He was from the very affluent East Coast. And many of them sent money to help the Greeks with their plight. Not just for the revolutionary, but their main purpose was to build hospitals for the people over there that so desperately needed them. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting is he focused a lot of his efforts on the Isle of Corinth. And he funded what was one of the first hospitals ever to be developed in Corinth. I thought that was pretty interesting. Well, when he came back to the United States, this man willing to give his time, his effort, and his energy, he was offered a position. He was asked to be the director of what was then called the New England Asylum for the Blind. And he said, "Before I take this position, before I take this responsibility on, I need to study this. You know, I really want to help these people, but I want to see what the best way is for me to help them." So he spent a year traveling all around Europe to the different clinics, the different asylums for the blind in Europe, learning all he could. Because just prior to this time in Europe, they put the blind in institutions because they thought they were inhabited with demons. So after this year's time where he gathered all this information that he could, he became the director of the New England Asylum for the Blind. And his goal through all of this was to help these blind people to lead as normal a life as they possibly could. That they could get just as good an education as anyone else. Well, through his knowledge and through his learning, he became a leader in establishing and printing books for the blind. He helped develop in the United States what I think many of you have heard of, known as Boston line type. It's a raised letter form of Braille. Ultimately, Boston line type became what we know today as Braille. That's what it developed from. And through Dr. Howe's efforts, the very first Bible was developed for the blind. 8 volumes. But that was his first book that he wanted converted completely for the blind, was the Bible. Well, after a little while, this prominent colonel took an interest in what was going on. His name was Colonel Perkins. Very, very wealthy man. Very wealthy man. When he died, he left his entire fortune to this New England asylum for the blind. And it became known as the Perkins School for the Blind. And it still exists to this day in Boston after over 200 years. The Perkins School of the Blind. We had this special project when he first arrived. It was a woman by the name of Laura Bridgman. She was blind and she was deaf. And he wanted to teach this young woman. He wanted to develop teaching methods that would allow her to succeed in her life. And as he worked with different processes, he used a fingerspelling method that was, many believe, the very beginning of what we know today as American Sign Language. But he reached this woman, this Laura Bridgman, and she became the first person in the United States that was deaf and blind to become educated clear through the university level. Amazing thing. But what's ironic about this whole story is that Dr. Howe grew older and older. His eyesight failed more and more until eventually he himself became totally blind. But prior to his blindness, he married a young woman. It was an American writer named Julia Ward. They became a very famous couple in the Boston area. And after her husband became blind, she wrote this poem. She submitted it to the Atlantic Monthly in 1862. Later, this poem was matched with an old folk medley. If you would reach in front of you this morning, pick up one of your hymnals. Turn to page number 542. You'll see that poem. We know it today as the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Now I want you to think about this. As Julia wrote this song for her husband, whose eyes were growing dim, he'd worked with all of these blind people at this Perkins Institute for the Blind. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. When you understand the significance of that poem and the writer and the history of it, I think it adds a lot more meaning to the hymn, doesn't it? It really does. You know, here's her husband who had seen so much terrible suffering through his life. He dedicated his life to helping these handicapped people. Dedicated his life to helping those that were suffering, less fortunate. And here, in the waning years of his life, his wife reminds him, "Remember, dear, your eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." Let's turn over to Romans chapter 8. I want to talk the next couple weeks about the glory of the coming of the Lord. But not just the glory. I want to focus in on the glory that we will receive at Christ's coming. That's where I want to focus. And I really believe as you read through the words to the Battle Hymn of the Republic, I really believe that that's what Julia Ward was trying to help her husband focus on. You know that hymn? It became so famous that the Union Army in the Civil War, that was their theme song, if you will. Let's go to Romans chapter 8 and verse 16. Because you see, as we look more closely at this, we have to look through that window. We have to see that vision. That vision of what our role is going to be when our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ returns to this earth. Romans 8:16 says, "The Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God." Wow! What a statement. Did you hear that? We are children of God. In verse 17, "And if children, heirs also, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ." You see, now this is very critical right here. Very critical to our examination about the meaning of Christ's return and about our glorification. Because we're going to look at what that means. What that means to us personally. Glorification. I really believe that's what Julia Ward was thinking. You know, many times when we sing songs, we sing the words, but we don't really read the words. When we pick that hymn up sometime and just read it as if it were a poem and see if you get the same feeling, that's what she meant. Inspiring her husband to keep going. To keep struggling for the Lord. Many times without any pats on the back. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with Him, so that we may also be glorified with Him. Now that Greek word there for glorified, the Greek word there is sundoxazo. It's a mouthful, isn't it? But that literally means to exalt in the company of. To raise up. To lift high. You know, most of us probably have never been to a banquet where we were the person of honor at the table, where everyone came to give their respects to us and how wonderful we are. Has any of us had that? I know I haven't. But that's what the writer here is conveying to us. We will be honored, lifted up, glorified with Jesus Christ. Then in verse 18, it says, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. Verse 19 said, for the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. I look forward to the time when my destiny is going to be revealed. Do you? At that time when all the saints who've ever lived, their destiny will be revealed to them. We're talking clear from Abel to today. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? That's what Christ returns mean. That's what it means. It's going to be the revelation of glory, of that change that we will experience when Christ returns. In verse 20, it says, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of Him who subjected it in hope. Boy, everything around us goes through deterioration, doesn't it? Constant cycle. You know, when my wife and I moved back from Florida, you kind of forget about that cycle a little bit. Because everything's always green and growing in Florida. But you move here and you see that cycle. You know, we were took every chance that we could to get back to Ohio because we wanted a little bit of space. In Florida, you're right next to your neighbor. For years, the neighbor's phone would ring and I would answer our phone. So we took the opportunity when we had a chance to come back to Ohio. But you look out your window and you see the plants grow. You see them fall over and die. And they become the fertilizer for the next plant to grow and to die. And it's a constant cycle. Things are constantly living and dying. But it says it was subjected in hope. At the end of verse 20 there. The hope of what? The hope of what we've been talking about. The hope of the resurrection. The hope of glorification. The hope of a world where things don't live and die. That glorious hope. Let's read on in verse 21. That the creation itself will also be set free from its slavery to corruption. That bondage of dying. Do we see that cycle in our own lives? In our own families? Sure we do. I just did my grandmother's funeral a few weeks ago. My mother and I sat down and had a really long, serious talk about death and dying. 93 years old, that's how old my grandmother was. It's a long time to us. You know, each and every one of us know we're going to die. If Christ does not return in our lifetimes, we are going to die. It's part of the cycle. Our grandparents will die. Our parents will die. And we will die. And the cycle will continue You know, we're subject to corruption. Just like it says, the cycle of life and death. Into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. So what's the contrast there? What's going to happen when Christ returns? We are going to be born into glorified liberty as children of God. Verse 22 says, For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. In verse 23, and not only this, but also we ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for our adoptions as sons, the redemption of our bodies. Now these verses here in Romans 8, they should remind us how eagerly we should be wanting this. How we should want Christ to return with every fiber of our being. You know, I think as we get older, the more eager we are for that, aren't we? The more we hope for His return. And we all get older. Every one of us. You know, I had a couple of my friends send me some emails to remind me about aging. And they're pretty cute, I'll have to say, but it reminds you. I wrote a couple of them down that I'd share with you that were just really cute. So the reporter was interviewing a 104-year-old woman. And he asked her, "What do you think the best thing is about being 104? And she said, "No peer pressure." We're getting older. My personal favorite one, and this was sent to me by my mother. She said, "These days, half of the stuff in my shopping cart says, 'For fast relief.'" We're getting older. We're reminded of that cycle constantly, aren't we? That cycle just goes over and over. Solomon wrote about the cycle of life and death. But you see, creation groans. We should groan for the adoption as sons of God. When's the last time that you really, really prayed, "Father, send your son to this earth," and meant it with your whole heart and your whole being? That's what he's saying that we should be like. Let's drop down to Romans 28. Romans 8, verse 28. It says, "And we know that God causes all things to work for good to those who love God." But you see, we're getting older. But we know God has something special planned for us, don't we? We know He does. Even though we hear the prayer requests every week, even though we know none of us will escape death unless Christ returns first, it says to those who are called according to His purpose. In verse 29, for those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to become conformed to the image of His Son. That word image there, it's the Greek word eikon. It's where we get the word icon from. What's an icon? Something that's almost identical. Spit an image, you might say. Means likeness. We're going to be changed into the likeness of Jesus Christ. So that He would be the firstborn among many brethren. We are the children of God. We will be changed into the likeness of Christ. That's what we're going to be pursuing next week. What it will be like to be changed into the likeness of Jesus Christ. What it will be like to have a glorified body. What kind of characteristics will we have? You know, this vision should motivate us. It should inspire us, encourage us to keep going and never give up. We're going to look at the examples of our risen Savior to see what we will be like at that time. And we're going to look at the resurrecting chapters. 1 Corinthians 15 that we read this morning. And 1 Thessalonians 4. And I hope we can truly say when we're finished, just like Julia Howe wrote, mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. I pray that God gives us that vision. That vision of our own glorification. And through that vision will help us serve mankind and God Himself for all eternity.